It was, of course, Jefferson's gift at one time or another to put with eloquence the right answer to every moral question. In practice, however, he seldom deviated from an opportunistic course calculated to bring him power. Gore Vidal. So for today's episode of Liberty versus Power, with my good friend Patrick Newman, author of Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 to 1849, we're going to look at the turn of the Jeffersonian Revolution, particularly focusing on the second term, the Louisiana Purchase, and the consequences thereof. But Patrick, I want to start this episode by kind of going back a little bit and setting what I think is one of the aspects of early American history that we are obviously not told in schools, that you know it's something that comes through in the fifth volume of Conceived in Liberty. It comes through in your book that there really was a lot of interest in the establishment of governments outside of Washington, D.C. in the Constitution, right? There were concerted efforts to break away from the regime that had been established, particularly after the Constitution, and interest in kind of a politically decentralized sort of format. Jefferson himself had spoken in favor of such arrangements. But I think this is something that, you know, when we think about this period of time and we think about the consequences of the Louisiana Purchase, it's important to kind of keep that in the back of our mind when we think about, again, there were a lot of Americans, or at least a lot of residents of these territories that, you know, were perfectly fine thinking outside the box in the way that political arrangement should be had.
Yeah, so that's a great point. Basically, one thing I argue in my book is that I think the Louisiana Purchase was in many ways a turning point for the United States. It was enormously important in a history of cronyism. Not a lot of people realize that, because a lot of people don't know how much cronyism was connected with Western expansion and the actual expansion of the country. When we're taught history in high school, et cetera, we're usually taught that it was almost ordained that we were going to expand to the West Coast. The United States would include, you know, everything in the modern continental United States, as well as then Alaska and Hawaii. But it wasn't always so. A lot of people thought that there would be multiple confederacies. There could be Western governments. A lot of people thought the West Coast would be a separate republic. This even continued into the Civil War, when people thought California was going to secede. That's partially why we built the Transcontinental Railroad to bring them in. And this is it's crucial to recognize this, because it's crucial to remember and to realize that it's very hard to have a limited government over a large territory. Okay, small governments, a small government in terms of political economy is generally only possible under, a small territorial region. All right, so we can pretty much sum up and describe everything from the Revolutionary War through the Louisiana Purchase and so on, using Jefferson's phrase, the Empire of Liberty. Okay, this is the title of a Gordon Wood book, and Jefferson used this to describe his vision for what the North American continent would look like. Okay, Jefferson thought you would have, at the very least, a very states' rights-oriented single government, or more likely, you would have multiple confederacies throughout the continent that would be united through a common language, English, as well as constitutional norms. Okay, and this is something that's really important. This is a true ethos of your average American back then that totally gets overlooked, because it's just seen as, well, you need centralization and you need one government, but it wasn't always so.
Well, there's also some personal ambition at play here. One of the figures that is brought up in Conceived in Liberty 5 is a very fascinating character, a James Wilkinson, who saw himself. And when we're talking about the West in particular during these days, I mean, we're not necessarily talking about the Pacific Ocean, though that definitely comes into play. But we're thinking just, you know, west of the Appalachians, right? You know, Kentucky was the far west frontier. And yet you did have an attempt, particularly the economic impact of that Mississippi River, right? You know, one of the major early points of you know, foreign relations, right, was getting access to the Mississippi River. And this very interesting sort of background there with good old John Jay trying to get an agreement for kind of, you know, broad usage of that for the Americans and some division there. But if the American government can't get access to that Mississippi River, Mr. Wilkinson and some others in the West kind of recognize, okay, well, if Spain has access to what we need and the American government doesn't, then really what is in our best interest? Is it to ally with the ones with the river or those without? I get it's just some interesting overlooked little anecdotes here. Can you touch on a little bit about Mr. Wilkinson?
Yeah, of course. So this is something that when I read editing Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, you know, that fifth volume, I was absolutely delighted and fascinated by, because you don't hear about this. You don't hear about how Kentucky tried to go at it, led by James Wilkinson, to be its own state. You know, I never heard of the proposed independent state of Franklin, like an additional state basically made out of some of the land in that area. So the Mississippi River was very important in terms of controlling trade at this time period. Due to the Appalachian Mountains, if you were if you were in the West, so at the West, even something like Western Pennsylvania or Ohio, et cetera, you were closer in terms of closer economically to the Mississippi River than you were with the East Coast. So rather than ship your goods east to west, you would actually ship your goods north to south through the port of New Orleans, and then have it be carried up to the East Coast by boats, et cetera. So it was very important to have control of this Mississippi River. Now, Britain in the Treaty of France, in the Treaty of Paris after the Revolutionary War, had kind of given the United States the rights to use the Mississippi River, even though like they didn't really have control of it. This is a little bit of power politics going on by Britain trying to sort of play off potential enemies, against each other. And during this time period, there was a lot of Southerners and Westerners who wanted to use the Mississippi River, and Spain wouldn't let them. And the proposed Jay Gardoki Treaty with John Jay and Gardoki from Spain was basically going to relinquish the Americans' use of the Mississippi River, and Spain was generously prepared to enter into various other favorable arrangements to the United States. And Southerners and Westerners were very upset about this. Patrick Henry, who is a governor of Virginia, was very upset about this, and this would have been a major catalyst to potentially having multiple confederacies, because the South really wanted to use the Mississippi River, as did the West. And if the United States would not get control of the Mississippi River, then the country would fracture, or at least the land in that country would fracture. And this was seen in movements with James Wilkinson, who wanted to sort of work with Spain and not work the United States. So he was pushing for an independent state of Kentucky. Unfortunately for him, as well as really from you and I, our perspective, Kentucky only just entered in as a state into the Union, not as its own state. But this Mississippi River thing, I cannot stress this enough, how important this was really for the United States economy up until really the Civil War with the rise of railroads. So whoever controlled the Mississippi River controlled a lot of Western commerce as well as the Gulf. And so the United States wanted to have a stronger government that would allow him to take the Mississippi River.
And this is still an issue going again right up to the Louisiana Purchase. While the James Wilkinson initial sort of plot was what I believe 1780s, right? Later on, yeah. However, Mr. Wilkinson is once again part of a plot by former Vice President Aaron Burr to try to rally up old American troops and organize military action against Spanish-controlled New Orleans, with the explicit goal of creating, you know, a new government there with Aaron Burr at the head. And he brings in, you know, he talks to Andrew Jackson about it and William Henry Harrison, lots of interesting characters. And it's actually Wilkinson who, at this point, I think Wilkinson was on the payroll of the Spanish, Native American tribes, the British, the American government, Burr's group. I mean, it's just fascinating. He was definitely billing maximally. But you know, it's really still up to this point where there is still a lot of movement along these lines, and that kind of sets the stage for when we get this environment where, you know, the Louisiana Purchase comes to be. One of the other things I think is interesting is the historical framework that we're building off of here. We're thinking about, you know, Napoleon is at, you know, is kind of at his peak within France, right? There is a lot of stuff that's happening in the global environment that is also playing a role here in setting up, the Louisiana Purchase. Because, and originally, you know, the Louisiana Purchase was not, you know, it pushed by the Jefferson administration, but rather, as you outlined in the book, part of, you know, initial diplomatic talks, more broadly. Can you just talk about kind of the framework that gets us into the actual conversations of the purchase itself?
Yeah, sure. So just to sort of speed through the American history, which we've been covering in prior episodes, obviously the U.S. Constitution gets passed. And then in 1795, I believe there was Pinckney's Treaty, which basically allowed the United States to trade on the Mississippi River. This was done with a little bit of coercion in the sense that Spain was now fearful of, after Jay's Treaty, of an alliance between Britain and the United States. So this is sort of, well, we're able to, one, once again, sort of use our might to threaten to get what we want. And of course, this, I believe it was Robert Morris who noted that this would increase land values in that area of which he held. So there you go. You got all of the crony interest there. And by 1800, so around when Jefferson became president in 1801, there was a lot of sort of worldwide politics going on that, you know, it tangentially would affect the United States. Most notably, Spain had secretly agreed to transfer its control of Louisiana to France. Okay, now a couple of things. Louisiana back then did not just refer to the state of Louisiana, which we have now. Okay, New Orleans was the most important part of that. All right, obviously it's a port city. It's at the end of the Mississippi River. It's right on the Gulf. But Louisiana, the land stretched all the way up to basically Montana. So you can look at a map online and you can just see how large this area was. And so transferring it from Spain to France was obviously a major power play because the Spanish government was seen now as very decrepit. It was sort of holding on to a crumbling empire. It had acquired, hundreds of years ago, et cetera. Louisiana itself had bounced around in control. And Spain says they're going to transfer it to France, provided that France helps them install some Spanish royalty into a various government in Europe. And France agrees never to transfer to Great Britain or the United States. Okay, so unfortunately for Spain, France basically said no. We're not going to do that. The United States was worried when France had control of Louisiana because they said, all right, here is now a different animal than what we've dealt with Spain. You've got Napoleon. He is currently, you know, riding high in Europe. Then there's a string of successes in the early 1800s. So clearly he had potential. But very quickly on, Napoleon realized that it just wasn't feasible to have a French presence in North America, colonies, et cetera, especially when he had to deal with war in Europe and Great Britain. Okay, so this Louisiana issue featured prominently in the United States politics at the time. Jefferson had initially wanted to just purchase New Orleans, or at least get control of the Mississippi River, but then the entire land soon became available to him, and this was an enormous temptation.
Yeah, they made a deal too good to pass up. Remind me the details of the deal itself. $15 million for a whole bunch of land?
Yeah, it was $15 million. And so for our modern readers, $15 million, you're like, well, that's nothing now. You know, governments spend trillions. And even back then, actually, so even adjusted for inflation, it was a bargain for the land. It really was when you just think of the massive amount. Napoleon wanted money and he wanted it fast because he wanted to start a new war. So he needed some quick cash.
And so this is something that is usually kind of sold as an obvious good move, right? I think the typical high school textbook may even mention a little bit of constitutional concerns at the time, that ultimately this was just too much, such a good steal. You could not pass it up. But I think it's interesting from this perspective, and I really think this chapter is one of the very best in really highlighting the difference of the narrative that you have outlined here, building off of Rothbard's work, because again, it's the impact of this absolutely corrupting the political ideals of what we think about with Jeffersonian politics, right? And I love the way that you start off this chapter, framing it with the death of Hamilton, how his death in 1804 was the hammered the nail into the Federalist coffin. But while the reactionary forces decayed, their special interest policies lived on, for slowly but surely the libertarian Republicans embraced statism. And so that it is this move, because of, touching on the aspects that we were talking about last week with kind of the recognition that with the drawing back of the spending programs of the Federalist regime, things like that, it's not only important just in a tax aspect, right? Like, oh, well, yeah, this is going to create more burdensome taxes on farmers and things like that. But there really is a corrupting element here when you think about the creation of new government offices, when you think about money spent and investments that have to be allocated through the political process. You start dealing with sectional differences and different considerations in here. The growth of this major increase of spending done through questionable constitutional grounds, though from the perspective of the way that we understand the reason for the Constitution, it was explicitly designed to expand the government, not to limit it. And therefore, it can be very fairly argued, as was at the time, that this was a constitutional move, even if it went against the Jeffersonian principles and that the strict reading of the Constitution that the old Republicans that we've been praising, that strategic pivot, there is a sound legal argument in defense of the Constitution, but it goes against that work being done by, in theory, the political party in power right now.
Yeah, so this is a very important point to understand regarding the Louisiana Purchase and just what exactly it did to the Republican Party, because in many ways it's sort of this, it was this corrupting agent, because it swelled the amount of land in the country to an enormous size, and this led to all sorts of changes in the Republican Party, which we will get to. But it was this usually when the Louisiana Purchase is discussed in high school, American history textbooks or even college American history textbooks, it's described as one of the most important and beneficial laws in United States history, and it's generally regarded as Jefferson's best legislation. So that's when people who usually are Jefferson haters, they'll say, well, he did that. He did the Louisiana Purchase, which of course, from our perspective, is probably like his worst thing that he did, right? Because by pushing for this, it really did open up Pandora's box, so to speak, to broad constructionism, all right? The Constitution is intended by the Federalists, it does allow for the purchase and annexation and incorporation of territories into the United States. They intended this, okay? And many Republicans also argued along these lines. But Jefferson was dedicated during this time period to upholding his strict constructionist view. And his logic was basically saying, okay, we can read into the treaty-making power, because of course there has to be a treaty in order to purchase the land, from another country. But he was saying, well, once we do that, well, then, the powers are boundless. So wouldn't it be better to just pass an amendment, pass an amendment allowing or explicitly enabling us to do that, then we can purchase the territory. And for this, it's really the precedent. So it's the idea that saying, all right, we're in control of the government. We could read the Constitution broadly, or we could stick by our principles, read the Constitution strictly, and then we're going to set a good precedent. Because even this way, it would still be a problem if Louisiana was purchased, but it would have been less a problem because at least there would have been an amendment. Okay, but Jefferson ultimately said he discarded this this possibility. He said, "All right, we'll pass an amendment after the fact," which is completely useless. Then it defeats the purpose of actually having a binding constitution. And once he did that, once he sort of broke his rule, once he stuck his hand into the cookie jar, so to speak, well, then he really just said, "All right, well, why don't we use the Constitution? Read it broadly to accomplish other aims that we want." And then when that happened, the whole strict constructionist approach really suffered a fatal setback. So this Louisiana purchase has important implications, not just for territorial land, land mass and all of that, but also for the constitutional implications regarding other policy. So it's really important to understand that Jefferson, he was really torn by this, and he was at one point going to push for an amendment. And even though some people said Napoleon wasn't going to wait, Napoleon was going to wait. He needed the money. He wasn't going to. He was only going to sell it to the United States. So there wasn't someone else. He needed the money, and it could have gone through. But instead, Jefferson just basically decided to downplay constitutional issues. And once he did that, the die was cast, so to speak.
And I think that's what makes the Jeffersonian tenure. If it was anybody besides Jefferson sort of in that role, even if the same decisions were made, once you have, like literally the living philosopher, the embodiment of, values that you can only describe it inherently as Jeffersonian. When you have him as the head of state during this time, I think it also kind of shows the obvious limitations. You still have people out there that believe, oh, well, if only you have a constitutional framework that we stick really close to, if Jefferson can't do it, then who is, right? The idea that legal precedents and very strict interpretations of governing documents, that alone can stand against power, can defend liberty against power. I think this is a very important illustration of how that doesn't work, and that ultimately it's only by having people in that position that can say no, that can say no to that deal, that can stop it from happening. And I think it's interesting the way you lay out, because not only do we have the consequences just from a political president sort of standpoint, but there's also the personal relationships here, right? Because it wasn't simply Thomas Jefferson that ended up kind of going along with the convenient out here, but there are several old Republicans, the people that have been championing this very strict constitutionalist framework, borrowing from, trying to keep that anti-federalist sort of project, if you will, alive. A lot of them kind of went on board with this. You mentioned John Taylor of Virginia, John Randolph is a defender of the constitutionality as a loyal Jeffersonian, but that this kind of ends up being a breaking point here. Kind of talk a little bit about the personal relationships that are altered by this move within this kind of old Republic tradition.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a very important aspect of the Louisiana Purchase that really kind of it doesn't get looked at, because looking into the personal relationships and the unique bonds various individuals had is sort of overlooked in American history, particularly around this time. So there's a couple of things that need to be mentioned. One, the Republican Party, many of the leaders had sort of decided to downplay the constitutionality issue. This is notably John Taylor, who was briefly a senator during this time, as well as Congressman John Randolph. They did recognize that the constitutionality issue was an issue. Okay, so it was actually a problem. And this was it was brought up for basically two reasons that's important to distinguish between this. One, you genuinely had Republicans who were a little concerned at this. They recognized that, hey, is this constitutional? And also on the related note, does France actually have the right to sell us this land? That was a big sticking point in terms of proof of ownership, so to speak. The constitutionality issue was also brought up by Federalists, who were very upset at this. They were the minority party ever since the Revolution of 1800, and they realized that adding Louisiana to the United States would basically relegate New England to a perpetual minority, because all of these states in the West, they would be loyal to the Republican Party. They would basically be able to outvote the Federalists. So the Federalists wanted to use any tactic they could, and they brought up the constitutionality issue not as an actual sort of ideological motivation, but simply just to try and throw a roadblock in. So this is important because this has implications as well for later history. There are many who use the constitutionality issue simply as an obstructionist tactic. Okay, James Madison had kind of did that earlier. He was this big government guy, then he became this small government guy, and you know that was sort of an opportunistic switch. But Randolph, Taylor, Jefferson, they were all ideologically in favor of strict constructionism, but this time they just sort of decided to sweep it under the rug to get what they wanted, which was Louisiana. And because Randolph was a distant cousin of Jefferson, he was close with Jefferson, he was kind of Jefferson's man in Congress. This was, this was an important moment, especially because Randolph most famously became a critic of the Louisiana Purchase. So this constitutionality issue was brought up, but it was ultimately sidestepped simply because the Jefferson and the Republican Party, they wanted all of that land. And it was just at the end of the day, it was just too much land. The land corrupted the Republican Party.
And it's interesting is that there's a counter argument that was being made in some pockets of time that basically they too wanted the land, but thought ultimately kind of buying it was unnecessary because of the thought that, no, there's some military adventurism that you could have down here. You know, you get together a few militia groups and with the promise of being, you know, them being able to become very wealthy men by taking over some of these areas. Like there was a counter argument as well that, you know, you didn't need government to do it, that the farmers and the hunters out there could kind of take care of the Spanish on their own right. Getting together, which again, I just think is an interesting dynamic here. But if I recall correctly, John Randolph goes on to say that this moment, this decision with Louisiana Purchase, is the greatest curse that ever befell us. Right?
Infamously, he said that. So regarding your earlier point, this is what the Federalists wanted to do when Spain closed off use of the river because Americans were being disrespectful to Spain, at least not really closing off use of the river, basically just requiring them some extra payments. Federalists, including Hamilton, said, well, we just got to invade, then negotiate. And Republicans, even especially the Western ones, they didn't want war, so they fortunately said, no, we're not going to do this. And then the news of the sale from France came and changed everything and all that good stuff. But so Randolph, after the fact, after the Louisiana Purchase is passed in late 1803, Randolph in the second Jefferson administration and beyond started to realize that this was actually not as good of a purchase as he thought it was. And this was because, one, it was leading to more and more desires for land, right? Because once you have some land, then you need to expand more in order to protect the new frontier. Of course, then when you get the new frontier, then you need more land to protect, you know, the frontier, and then so on and so forth. And that also, this massive expansion, in order to keep it in the United States, to keep it from breaking apart, it's leading a lot of politicians to embrace government-funded public work. So internal improvements, roads, canals, etc., binding the extremities of this enlarged empire together. Okay. And it also, increase the power of the executive's influence in the legislative process, which Randolph didn't like. So he became sort of anti-Louisiana Purchase because he realized that sort of what a tripwire this whole thing was. And this was all tied in with him breaking with Jefferson on a number of Jefferson's expansionist policies that he pursued in his second administration after the Louisiana Purchase, because he was corrupted by it. So the land led to corruption, and the corruption led to cronyism.
Well, this kind of gets to, you know, one of the great libertarian memes of, you know, who will build the roads. This kind of goes directly to, you know, this being a very, very important issue, actually, because, you know, as you outline, well, I think one of the things that I really enjoy is you're highlighting the degree to which, you know, a lot of the arguments for pumping money into these internal improvements was on the importance of building up. Yeah, the perception that state investment, that private investment in roads, canals, and all the things needed for internal trade would not be up to what was necessary to kind of get the economy going. But as you point out, you know, the economy of America was greatly influenced by what was going on in Europe, and the degree to which that attracted capital to the shipping industry and New England interests, I think, in particular, taking advantage of the trade embargoes going on with Europe. You know, there was marketplaces for these goods paying very, very good money because of the disruptions in, you know, Atlantic trade, European trade, that, you know, some of the arguments being made in favor of, again, the spending aspect that came after the purchase itself, you know, the economic analysis is not as complete as if we look a much broader scale at what's going on globally.
Yeah, so this is a great point, and this is especially an issue in traditional American history, because they say, well, you have to have the government build roads, you have to have the government build infrastructure, so, well, even if you had potential problems, well, this is just the only way it could be. We even see this today, you know, with infrastructure bill, whatever, just assume that, well, the government has to be in charge of infrastructure. And that's just simply not true. One, there was private roads and you know, with some government assistance on the state and local level, but it was generally minor. Roads were built to connect towns. Merchants would pay for the construction of the roads, even though they might not get a direct return on the road, but they would get the indirect return through more commerce coming into the town, boosting their sales and so on. So you did have private enterprise produce what are traditionally thought of as public goods, and that these privatized roads, canals, railroads later on, et cetera, inexorably were much more efficient than the government enterprises. Okay. And I loved it when I found that explanation. I think it was by this engineer, Benjamin Latrobe. And he brings this up, and I said, oh, this is such a genius explanation that, well, one of the reasons why there was a relative lack of funds for private infrastructure during this time period was not due to the fault of the free market. It's just that so much private investment was going into the shipping industry because it was very profitable for Americans to kind of play both sides and to engage in smuggling and to ship goods to nations at war with each other, and that this was a diversion. This is a government diversion of funds. This wasn't entirely done by the private sector. So in the absence of the Napoleonic Wars, if we just pretended for some reason that they never happened, you would have seen much more private investment in infrastructure, even more than what already occurred. So it's important to note this just to see, because it's such a fascinating explanation, but it also shows that, yeah, the free market can do things. You don't need the government to funnel money into various taxpayer boondoggles, et cetera.
And of course, unfortunately, one of the big champions of this entire process of really pumping money into canals and roads and other internal improvements is our boy Albert Gallatin, who actually creates, you know, he has this entire system that he proposes. One of the things I think is interesting is, again, if we think about the way that something as, you know, or, you know, mundane as road construction really does play into the corrupting aspect, is you highlight the example of the National Road that was plagued with delays, and, you know, they make decisions that are overly expensive because of the federal money involved. It ends up becoming something that is little used. The way that, you know, we saw this particularly with the boom of the railroad industry, right? The way that certain routes go are purely political in nature. And then it also just adds new cards to the deck for wheeling and dealing. You know, I think Senator Clay, you highlight, kind of starts recognizing that, hey, if I want to bring money to Kentucky to get this road done here where I'm at, then what I need to do is start working with other states. So, you know, pat their back for spending, and then we can all benefit, right? And so it really creates this environment. With the other side of it is kind of going back to the point about the Republican Party really embracing this almost, you know, imperialistic aspect of you're using the funds from the internal improvement side to make sure that Federalist-dominated New England states don't get any ideas about separating, you know, which comes up from time to time, right? You know, secession and these sort of things were not simply a Western frontier thing. They were not a Southern thing. They were discussed in the North. It turns out they find that you know, getting funding for internal improvements is a good way of downplaying some of the radicals among them, and making sure that you know, there is no state out there getting too many questions about self-determination in their own right.
Yeah, when it comes to internal improvements, there's a tremendous amount of cronyism that's involved. I was always influenced. One of the first books I ever read was The Myth of the Robber Barons by Burton Folsom. And when he goes into how the government transcontinental railroads, Union Pacific and Central Pacific in particular, were built, they were built very poorly. They used the wrong materials. It was hastily done. There were these winding routes because they were trying to collect more money, et cetera, as opposed to James Hill's private Great Northern. I was always very influenced by this argument, and I really try to show this in my own book, Cronyism, because yeah, these constraints do affect government projects, right? So the national road was it was built with costly materials. There were political appointees of people in charge of creating the road that shouldn't really have been in charge of this, but they were there because it was a patronage job. There were political considerations for the route of the road, and Gallatin basically told Jefferson that, hey, you know, the road should go through various towns because we need them for an election. I think in one case, one of them was it was also Gallatin's hometown. So, you know, a little bit of cronies and personal sweetener there. And yeah, this is a huge issue because you see it throughout government investment, so-called investments, that this is the inevitable result. So, and, you know, we really pushed for the keep New England in the Union. We had the land speculation schemes of the Yazoo. We were trying to satisfy them, or Jefferson is trying to placate them that way. The internal improvements is really to keep the West from leaving, right? And this is always the idea that you got to give them a sweetener, right, if they're supposed to stay in the Union. And this is a big issue. One other point I just want to mention, when we talk about various people, free market people, otherwise coming out in favor of internal improvements, it is important to note that many laissez-faire economists at this time had also made, unfortunately, in our opinion, they made exceptions, saying that, oh, well, under certain conditions, the government can build roads, like Adam Smith or other people, whether it's military necessity, like for national defense, or just something else, etc. And Americans, they accentuated that. They thought, one, well, we can spend more money if we have all these fiscal surpluses, and if we want to keep the West in the Union, or if it's underdeveloped, etc. But it ultimately came from some of the free market economists, the economic thought at this time, not really fully recognizing the errors in their own logic. Ideas do have consequences in the policy realm. All right. And it's just important to note this. I remember reading one time Charles Sumner, a noted free market Republican, the later Republican Party, actually had read John Baptiste Say, a treatise on political economy. And he had underlined the parts where Say had come out in favor of internal improvements. Right. And so it's like it's an interesting dynamic. So it's just important to keep that in mind. Jefferson was anti-internal improvement. He recognized the corruption that it would cause, the political issues. He was familiar with free market thought. But once again, he acquiesced particularly when he realized that he had to keep, you know, he had all this land in Louisiana. They better start building public works to connect the West with the East.
Well, you mentioned that the next topic I wanted to go over, because it wasn't simply the Louisiana Purchase, the internal improvements within there that became a dark spot of this time frame, but also, again, some of the ramifications of the Yazoo scandal that we mentioned briefly in the last episode. And really, you know, it kind of starts off with actively bailing out land speculators here. And so we kind of start setting the framework of privatized gains, socialized losses. Can you just touch on this role? We're going to get to John Marshall here in a second, but kind of just setting up the dynamic of kind of the big business of land speculation and the way that this kind of, you know, really is a illustration of legal privileges going directly to benefit a, you know, financial corporate class.
Yeah, exactly. So land speculation was an enormously important aspect of cronyism in the past in ways that it's not now, simply because most land has been appropriated and somehow, you know, things have been built on it. But so back in the day, and this is something Rothbard mentions, conceived in liberty, this comes from Ethics of Liberty, his natural rights political philosophy, that for something to be truly owned, it has to be homesteaded. You have to mix your labor with it. So you have to build a fence on a plot of land. You have to cut down trees. You put a farm, whatever. So the gradual process of, the process of settlement into the West would have been much more gradual if it was through this means, right? But instead, what you can do is the government can simply just declare ownership of land, saying, well, all of that land is ours, and we're going to defend it with military arms and all of that. And then they can just sell those claims to speculators, who in turn can sell them to settlers, in many cases, people who've already lived on the land, and say, oh yeah, now you got to pay for this because we technically own the land, you don't. It's a huge instance of cronyism. So in the 1790s, Georgia had basically sold all of this land to various speculators. And this was the land of Alabama and Mississippi, sort of the so-called Yazoo lands. And then the Georgia legislature wanted to revoke it. And Hamilton and the Federalists say, no, you can't do that because of the contract clause. And this sort of had remained unresolved when Jefferson became president. So Jefferson ultimately had wanted to compromise with the land speculators because many of them were from New England. And after the Louisiana Purchase, many people in New England were now sort of the elites were kind of rumbling threats of secession or just something, because they realized they would lose all of their political power from Louisiana. So Jefferson wants to set aside some land of, you know, as sort of as compensation for the speculators. And this was something that really angered John Randolph, because he's saying, wait a second, this is very clearly like the Federalists, what the Federalists were doing in the 1790s. Do we really want to go down this road? And Randolph was, he was a big fighter of this, and he kept on delaying it until the matter went to the Supreme Court. But this itself, just this Jefferson's moderation regarding the Yazoo land issue is a big turning point, because now he's actually sort of pursuing his own cronyism by saying, no, we need to bail out these Yazoo land claimants. We need to set aside some land and or some money, and we need to do this because we have to keep our country from breaking apart.
When it comes to Supreme Court on this issue, one of the things I love is you highlighting the questionable relationships of some of the Supreme Court justices to this entire racket of land speculation. Can you please touch on the great John Marshall on this issue and why this might not have been completely on the up and up necessarily?
Yeah, so John Marshall is one of those great instances of cronyism, because a lot of people, you learn about John Marshall. I took AP US history when I was in high school. I've read a lot of history books. I've read a lot of stuff on John Marshall and his constitutional opinions, and you got all these people.
The great man of the court.
The great John Marshall. He's the big government advocate. You don't learn this at all. And I just find this simply astonishing, bordering scandalous, is two things. One, that John Marshall and his brother James were enormous land speculators, right? So you're dealing with someone who's like, who has dealt with immense amount of land speculation, including in Virginia, and that these guys are also linked with who was at the time in the 1790s, the one of the wealthiest, richest men in America, Robert Morris. James Marshall, John Marshall's brother, had married the daughter of Robert Morris, and they had engaged in various speculation schemes together. So when you read this, you're like, whoa, wait a second. Why was I not informed of this at all? Like, this might influence some people's opinions of this man. And John Marshall was someone who was very concerned about what would happen in the Yazoo, what would happen with the Yazoo claimants. Because John Marshall was undergoing, he was suffering a similar experience in Virginia. There was a large land grant in Virginia that the Virginia legislature had wanted to rescind. The Marshalls were involved in it. They didn't want that to happen. So the case of Fletcher v. Peck, all right, which is a Supreme Court case. This is John Marshall recalling what we spoke about in an earlier podcast regarding judicial review used to protect Federalist cronyism. John Marshall is using judicial review to overturn a state law, Georgia, basically rescinding the Yazoo land grants and saying, nope, can't do that. You got to provide compensation for them. And okay, so why did he want to do that? Obviously, John Marshall was a big government person ideologically. He wanted to find some defense of this using the contract clause and all of that. But he also clearly wanted to protect his own land speculation. So he wanted to set a precedent for this. And you saw this in later Supreme Court cases where the Supreme Court upheld the validity of the Marshall's titles to land in Virginia. Now, to be fair, Marshall had excused himself from these various court cases, but Joseph Story, who was also on the Supreme Court, he was someone who had also worked for land speculators. He had also worked for the Yazoo land speculators. He's basically doing Marshall's dirty work on the Supreme Court. So it's a fascinating story. It's one of the it's similar to the George Washington, moving the Capitol to benefit himself. This is just like a very simple, tight explanation of just personal cronyism. And what makes it all the more remarkable is this is a chief justice. This is supposed to be a person who's above all this. He's a great legal analyst. He's kind of making deals basically to line his own pockets. And you're going, well, it's good to know nothing's changed in United States history.
Well, speaking of figures that don't mind lining their own pocket, the next topic, let's go a little bit into the fun of the adventures of West and East Florida. Which once again pulls back in a diplomatic issue. Once again, it brings us back to this expansionist impulse that the Jeffersonians had taken on. And it also brings into the story one of my favorite figures, Minister Talleyrand of France, very flamboyant, an interesting character in his own right. There is issues with – so when we think about – West Florida in particular, we can't let the name fool us. West Florida is, Louisiana, Mississippi, right? As well,
So West Florida at the time. So you have to imagine. Okay, so Florida. For those of you who, one of the things I really wanted to do in my book is to put pictures, which probably would have helped because there's like a lot of geography stuff. So at the time, Florida, the panhandle of Florida, right? So those stomping grounds, the panhandle of Florida extended all the way to New Orleans. So the little juts in the states of Mississippi and Alabama, the modern states to the coast, those did not exist. And the panhandle of Florida, because of New Orleans, was the most important part of Florida. When people spoke about Florida, they generally spoke about the panhandle because that was New Orleans, that was the Gulf. Really, East Florida, which is what we think of as Florida now, right? So everything from modern day Jacksonville to Miami to Tampa, the peninsula was almost seen as sort of unimportant. You'd basically throw a couple military forts there so you can police the Gulf trade and all of that, keep other people there. But, you know, that was the real meat was in West Florida. Okay, so Jefferson and the Republicans had sort of part of, in terms of the cronyism and the corruption, they had always insisted that Florida was part of Louisiana, right? They're like, oh, well, France, you also sold us Florida. And France was like, no, because Spain said, no, that's not part of Florida. It's not there at all. It's a separate entity. And so then Jefferson basically decides to maneuver to acquire West Florida. Okay. So the land right by New Orleans. Okay. And so on. And what basically the strategy that he uses, and this is something that infuriated Randolph, was basically he wanted to bribe France to coerce Spain into giving up Florida. Okay, and this is where Talleyrand was involved. It was basically saying like, yeah, give us a little sweetener and, you know, we'll get this job done for you. So Jefferson didn't want to tell this to the people. He wanted Congress to secretly appropriate, which can really only be accurately described as a slush fund of money to basically be used to pay off French politicians to then sell West Florida. And this was something that had just revolted John Randolph. He's saying, okay, now we're engaged in secret deals. This is all, you know, the sordid bribery. And what is this going to do to our relationship with Great Britain if they find out that we're secretly bribing France? Like, won't this actually increase foreign tensions? Because now Britain's going to be upset. They could potentially turn on us, et cetera. And this was just seen as a whole, a minefield. And though Congress passed what was known as the $2 million Act, basically never got implemented because Randolph was scheming to delay appropriations, and then problems with Great Britain, et cetera, had caused more and more controversy over this. But it was very important. This we did the whole history of Florida and acquiring Florida is like a great example of cronyism. And so West Florida was the main prize. Jefferson wanted to bribe France to coerce Spain into doing it. Randolph wasn't going to have any of it.
Yeah. And then this, you know, this skirmish, the scenario here, you know, it's really, you know, through for the next, you know, over a decade, or I guess you give it around a decade, right, of just kind of tensions between Florida, you know, Spanish Florida and American interests, the provoking discontent amongst the population, having people operate on taking over territory here and there. And Andrew Jackson later on becomes a big figure and using his sort of military wits to invade the area and around Pensacola. Where does Jackson invade?
Where does Jackson, he invaded twice.
Yeah.
So first you had this little movement. It was around 1810 regarding this guerrillas took the land. So the part of the panhandle, this is a little bit, the part of the panhandle that was closest to New Orleans. Again, remember it went all the way to New Orleans. You originally had some guerrillas. They went in there, they took it over. They wanted to become an independent state. And then Madison said, no, you're going to be included into Louisiana. And yeah, you can't say anything about it. Tough. And then you had Jackson during the War of 1812. He invaded the panhandle, what's sort of now seen as the modern panhandle, a little bit closer, acquiring that land. This is the land that became the little coastal parts of Alabama and Mississippi. Okay. And then Jackson invaded it again after the War of 1812. During the Seminole War, and he had invaded, and this was seen as a big pretext for the United States to bully Spain into selling Florida. So there was many conquests of Florida. It was really just like a repeated attempt of the United States slowly just biting away Florida, and like poor Spain and the residents of Florida, they're dealing with this. But it's fascinating because Florida is just super important for the South and the United States at this time. I mean, it's seen as it's this big protector of the Gulf, and whoever owns Florida can really sort of monopolize the Caribbean trade.
within this, that there is also a perception of Madison's role in this as well, that you, some of the compromises from the old Republicans. You have a great quote. I consider this matter as fairly at issue, whether this nation is to be governed by a secret Machiavellian, invisible, irresponsible cabinet, or the principles of the Constitution. You know, is Madison really sort of in much the same way as perhaps Hamilton, sort of this Machiavellian figure, really kind of wielding true political power, you know, pushing all the right buttons with Jefferson, manipulating the political landscape here, you know, the different debates over again, trying to get regional factions involved and some of that aspect that comes to dominate, you know, American politics going up the Civil War, these sectional disputes. You know, what is Madison's role through this period and kind of setting up, you know, this sort of corruption of the Republican Party?
Enormously important, because he's really the head of the so-called moderates. So these are the ex-Federalists that joined the Republican Party because they were sort of disturbed at the Federalists for going too far or for not bringing them in on their racket. So they didn't really want to get rid of the Federalist cronyism, maybe downsize it a little bit or just put themselves in charge of it. And so Madison was made Secretary of State by Jefferson, and Secretary of State was seen as a very important stepping stone of the presidency. And it really was an important stepping stone for the early 1800s. It's something that's not understood now. And so Madison was a very big sort of corrupting agent in Jefferson's ear. You know, he thought the Louisiana Purchase was constitutional. He was okay with bailing out the Yazoo land speculators. He was in favor of internal improvements. He wanted to take over Florida, and he made many steps to do so in his own presidential administration after Jefferson, you know, from 1809 to 1817. And he was very important in corrupting Jefferson. And this is why Randolph was always sort of seething at him. He was, you know, accusing him of being sort of this Federalist kind of whispering in Jefferson's ear. So when I read books of Randolph describing this, I think of Madison as sort of like this Grima worm tongue from Lord of the Rings, and you have Jefferson, he's like this aging Theoden, and you know, he's Madison sort of telling him that, oh yeah, you can do all this stuff, you know, as long as it's all just, you give it a good constitutional description, you know, the justification and all of that. So Madison's very important. This is why I'm negative on him. In many ways, I'm sort of more critical of him than Hamilton, though I think Hamilton was much worse. I definitely don't pull my punches when it comes to Madison, because sometimes it's the moderators that are just as bad as the big statists, because they're the ones who are causing the reform coalition to falter. And so this is sort of Madison's legacy. I don't think he had a positive impact. I mean, there were good things he did. I'm not being like super, I don't want to be like super harsh on him, but ultimately, at least in the modern United States, you know, after the you know, during the 1790s and the 1800s, the 1810s, he really just kind of comes across as a rhino, really, a Republican in name only, right? Which is, you know, something that, of course, is used in earlier, you know, early 2000s, but it has just as much relevance to the Republican Party of the Jeffersonian era.
Well, it seems like in many ways, I mean, you could argue that Madison was far more effective at growing government than Alexander Hamilton, because he kind of had that cloak, right? And particularly the impact, I mean, the Federalists get thrown out of power after the 1800s, but it's the Virginian dynasty that comes into play from there on out. You know, they dominate the White House for a very long time. And it's sort of Madison that ends up kind of setting the stage for this decay of the Republican Party. I think that's one of the best aspects of this book from just a narrative standpoint, that, you know, because there is a lot of sympathy to Madison's ideas within, you know, libertarian circles. And I think that you do a great job of kind of, you know, taking off the mask there of a Madison the libertarian. You know, let's go ahead and end on one last point. Yet another example of Republican decay. You know, they embrace, you know, protection of domestic merchants, manufacturers, and kind of setting the stage not only for the embargo that even, you know, high school textbooks will tell you was a bad idea, but really just a kind of a bellicose sort of stand here with Great Britain generally. Again, keep going back to that issue of land and expansion. I mean, it was the explicit goal of the Jeffersonians by this point to go after Canada, to go after South America, right? You know, the idea of, you know, this broad growing empire of power, you know, it is really much at play here. And it ends up with heightening tensions between the US and the UK. And, you know, you have, you know, and which leads to the disastrous policies of the embargo, which, you know, thankfully were kind of undermined by smuggling. But, you know, this is, you know, perhaps the most obvious black eye of the Jeffersonian administration, but, you know, just kind of hitting some of the unique aspects of this kind of, you know, to me, it just, this simply highlights kind of the complete capitulation of the Jeffersonian Republican Party to, you know, the saber rattling of the Hamiltonians.
Oh, absolutely. And this is why I think the first Jefferson administration was great, with the exception of the Louisiana Purchase, which came at the end. But the second administration is just a disaster. So by the time Jefferson leaves office in March of 1809, his Republican Party has changed tremendously from just 10 years ago when they were fighting the Federalists. So one of the things Jefferson was also doing in his second administration was making moves to please manufacturers and shippers, because they were concentrated in New England and he wanted to win that constituency, bring them into the Republican Party. This is always Jefferson's goal: keep the empire growing, bring more people in to the Republican Party to ensure Republican Party dominance. Okay. And some of the laws Jefferson pushed for, the Embargo Act, was something very extreme that most shippers didn't support, though manufacturers did support. But it's important to note that, you know, Jefferson's justification for doing all this was kind of a lie, because he always said, we're going to engage in an embargo with Great Britain because we want to show them that they can't impress our sailors and that we're going to use this as a means to prevent war. Or at the same time, Jefferson's also building up the military, and he's preparing for a secret invasion of Canada in the winter of 08 and early 09 that basically gets stopped at the last moment. Because what Jefferson really wanted was, he wanted Canada, and he also wanted Florida. Okay, and this is the issue of the corrupting nature of land. Once you have Louisiana and you have the New Orleans, well, now you have to have Florida, because how is New Orleans going to be protected if you don't have Florida? How are you going to be able to control the Gulf trade if you don't have Florida? And then when you have Louisiana all the way to the west, you also want to get Canada. You want to bring Canada into the country, and that way you can totally monopolize the trade of the Great Lakes region, okay? And this is just continually the problem of territorial expansion always leads to more territorial expansion, all right? So these various laws, such as Jefferson's Embargo Act, which I often teach it to my students, is sort of our nation's first lockdown, kind of, right, where we say we're not going to import or export goods on American ships, was completely disastrous, right? It led to enormous amounts of unemployment in idled ships, of sailors and ships, and hurt industry, to hurt farmers because they couldn't sell their goods. It led to smuggling. Jefferson was using U.S. soldiers to prevent people from peacefully trading with Canadians. I mean, just like a total disaster, right? When you're like, Jefferson, what are you thinking of? And poor Albert Gallatin, who was against this embargo, was basically saddled with enforcing it, and the Treasury bureaucracy blows up with all the edicts and rules and regulations of all this stuff. And it really just shows you the evolution of the Republican Party. Went from the reform group fighting the Federalists, so this liberty fighting power, right, to then liberty moderating and only moderately decreasing cronyism, to then liberty getting corrupted by power, to then supporting its own cronyism, which basically culminates into a war of conquest, the War of 1812.
Well, I think that is a good part for us to leave off on, kind of setting the stage for President Madison coming up soon. If you have not yet got your copy of Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 to 1849, we have a discount for you using coupon code LVP. We have a discount for both the paperback and hardback versions of the book. If you've been enjoying this podcast, you got to get the book. I believe there's also an audiobook in the works that'll be coming here shortly. But
let's just also note that inflation is at 7%, right? And the Mises Institute, we're lowering prices on goods. So it's, this is our way of fighting inflation, right?
Absolutely. And cronyism and all its sorts. So again, if you are enjoying this podcast, again, we've gotten some great responses. I want to thank you all for that. Please rate, review, subscribe, you know, do all that sort of stuff you're supposed to do with podcasts. Again, we got a lot of great episodes down the pipeline. With that being said, for Patrick Newman, this is Tho Bishop. Thank you for listening to Liberty versus Power.
Oh, Tommy, what are you saying?